Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for October 1st, we'll call it, 2023. Although as I'm dialing in, it just crosses over into Monday, October 2nd. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and this is our post-Wrestle Dream audio here on the Daily Cast, Wrestling Night in America. And what a show it was. Really excited to be able to talk about this with you and with my co-host, PWTorch.com contributor Brandon LeClaire, who is standing by. Don't forget that you can call in and talk with us. 515-605-9345 is the number to call. Press 1 if you'd like to talk, or you can email us at wnialivecast@gmail.com. Although we are going on the air live after AEW Wrestle Dream, we will also be talking a little bit about NXT No Mercy from last night, and we do have an email question focused on that show to cover as well. So without further ado, I bring on my co-host for this evening, Brandon LeClaire. Brandon, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight.
Thanks for having me, Greg. Glad to be here.
Absolutely, and thanks for hanging up late with us.
Yeah, it's kind of par for the course with these AEW shows. It certainly feels like midnight is about the time that they're going to get over, which, I mean, I do at least appreciate. Tony Khan has been pretty forthcoming with the fact that these shows run 4 hours pretty much on the dot, and that's exactly what they did again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know what? I guess the whole thing is, as long as the shows are really good, it makes it a lot more tolerable. There's not a lot of padding in between the shows, certainly not as much as what you see with WWE. And sometimes I kind of wish there was a little more, because I'm so used to WWE pay-per-views where I can kind of like do the dishes in between matches, or go pick out my clothes for the next day, or, you know, go to the bathroom. But with the AEW shows, you kind of feel like there's just not enough time in between matches to do any of that.
Yeah, so from an analyst perspective, from my chair over here, it is a huge disadvantage and something that I much prefer WWE's way of operation when it comes to this, because covering the show live and in real time, I have absolutely no time for anything. Not only can I not do post-match analysis during the show itself, but yeah, like you said, I mean, you barely have time to get up and go to the bathroom if you need to. The in-between packages, promo packages, are so quick that it's just rapid succession. And I think you see the downsides of that in crowd reactions, because as the show progresses, it becomes very, very hard for the crowd to stay fully involved and fully invested. And I think that's just because of the breakneck pace that these shows go at. But on the other end of the spectrum, I also understand that Tony Khan, you know, wants to deliver really good shows from start to finish that make people feel like they got their money's worth, even when they don't have a big marquee matchup on the card. So there's two sides to it, and I understand both.
Well, let's dive into Wrestle Dream here tonight, Brandon. I thought this was a really strong show, a really strong thumbs-up show, especially from an in-ring point of view. You know, you can nitpick some of the finishes, I suppose. You can nitpick some of the stories and things like that. But just up, I'm looking at my list, just up and down the card, par for the course for AEW. You know, this is a company that, if you look at the live attendance, is not where it was a year ago. If you look at the television ratings, perhaps not where it was a year ago. I think they just recently drew a low Wednesday night viewership for Dynamite. And yet they keep putting on just absolutely stupendous pay-per-views. But that doesn't seem to be enough. That doesn't seem to be resonating with the audience at large, who are not watching the weekly television in numbers that you would expect based on the quality of pay-per-view. They're not attending the live shows in the numbers that you would expect based on the quality of pay-per-view. So Where is that disconnect, do you think?
I'm not sure. They certainly don't have that disconnect internationally. I mean, we saw, of course, the just incredible history-making attendance at Wembley. It was particularly, you know, kind of crazy to watch some of the London game this morning between the Jags and the Falcons and think that, man, you know, just a little bit over a month ago, AEW was in that building. It's hard to imagine them going from that to struggling to pull 3,000 domestically at a lot of these shows. And I've mentioned more than a few times just how hard it is to get invested in a product that where the crowd looks so barren on such a regular basis. And it's not that WWE hasn't had these problems in the past either. It's just that they've done a much better job of hiding it when that's been the case. And so I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the answer is here. I mean, they have settled into presenting a product that their ardent fan base is rabid for. I mean, there is a subsection of this audience who believes that AEW can and will not do any wrong. And I think for them, I mean, this is the be-all, end-all. This is exactly what they want out of pro wrestling. But the live attendance domestically and the weekly television shows, the ratings that they've been pulling, I think is indicative that is not serving a larger audience. And something that WWE does in their way of presentation is connecting better with people. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I know that, I mean, I feel it on a personal level. Granted, do I think the wrestling in AEW is a significant step up from WWE for the most part? Sure. There are different things that WWE does that I prefer. There are some things that AEW does that I prefer. But I don't think that weekly AEW TV has been particularly strong, and I haven't felt that it's been particularly strong for a long time. But like you said, Greg, they just so regularly knock it out of the park with these pay-per-views that it's hard to write them off. So it's a struggle. I mean, I think, you know, like we'll get into NXT a little bit later and their show, No Mercy, last night. I have not watched NXT regularly since the start of the 2.0 era. But I've caught pay-per-views here and there or premium live events and thought largely they were very good. So they're not unlike AEW in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dig into WrestleDream here. You know, just Brandon, I kind of went on a tangent there with the AEW ratings and attendance vis-a-vis their pay-per-views. Didn't give you a chance to say what you thought of the show as a whole tonight.
Yeah, a definite thumbs up for me. I mean, this was not a card that I was particularly looking forward to on paper, but I did suspect that, like they usually do, they would deliver a really quality 3 to 4 hours of wrestling, and that's exactly what we got. I mean, pretty much from top to bottom, and then the surprise, I mean, certainly a surprise, but heavily hinted at, you know, heavily talked about online for a while, the arrival of Adam Copeland at the end of the show made it certainly feel like a much bigger night overall.
Yeah, let's start there because that was the biggest news coming out of this show. Tony Khan had been hyping a new era of AEW. There was no real mention of that throughout the show, and I'm guessing that Adam Copeland was not that new era. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that was the intention. I'm sure Tony Khan will be asked about in his post-show presser, which is going on or about to start as we speak here. I think when the rumors about Edge / Adam Copeland coming to AEW came about, you know, him and Christian are best friends going back to their pre-wrestling days. It made sense that Edge would get involved in Christian's storyline. But the way he got involved, not as a partner of Christian, but as an antagonist to him. Christian defeats Darby Allin 2 out of 3 falls match to retain the TNT Championship. Nick Wayne turns on Darby. Nick Wayne, Christian, and Luchasaurus attack Darby Allin, and then Sting after the match. Sting, who came out to try to help Darby Allin, and then Edge comes out to make the save, setting up at some point, maybe even at Full Gear in November, 3-on-3, 6-man tag match. Are you surprised that that's how they debuted Edge? And do you think that's the right move, or would you have rather have seen him side with the heel Christian?
I definitely would not have preferred to see him align with Christian. I mean, I do think that at some point I would like to maybe see Edge and Christian team again, or Adam Copeland and Christian team again. But for the time being, I think it would be mighty challenging to get a crowd to boo him at this stage. I mean, he is a huge, huge free agent acquisition. He is probably the you know, there's CM Punk and how big CM Punk was, and there's Bryan Danielson, and there's Jon Moxley, but Edge is really the first true WWE guy to jump ship. I mean, Edge is synonymous with WWE. There's no indie career prior to WWE. There's no, you know, he was not one of these guys who was brought in from the indies and then later became a WWE guy. He is a WWE guy through and through. And even when Christian has gone away, Edge has remained. And so this is a big deal. And to have put him in any position other than the saving babyface, I think would have been the wrong move for the debut. I think that I'm not sure that I love the idea of putting him opposite of Christian right out of the gate. That match is something they can obviously go to at any point during his run. But fans, I think, are going to want to see them go one-on-one at some point. And I don't know if that's, you know, at this stage of the game, a great matchup from an in-ring perspective. I mean, it's certainly very different than what AEW typically presents. It's just not what I think of when I think of, you know, what do I really want to see these two do under the umbrella of AEW. But I'm glad that they didn't go the heel route. I don't think that would have worked.
I was kind of the opposite of you. I thought they should have put Edge and Christian together. I mean, their story tells itself and has been told over and over again. And it just made almost too much sense. And as Edge comes out, I think, is AEW just kind of swerving us? Is this like every, you know, I think back to, you know, a storyline that WWE had years ago where Christian was going to return and be the one who, I think Matt Hardy was being driven off the road and stuff like that. Everybody knew it was going to be Christian who did it. And then, like, WWE swerves us and makes it Jeff Hardy who did it. And you're like, or maybe it was the other way around. I had the Hardys mixed up. But anyway, it was like, wait, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. But they just wanted to do it because everybody was expecting someone different. And my fear was that was what was going on. But as the story played out, I was kind of like, yeah, I kind of think it would be hard to bring Edge back as a heel. Like, I still believe that the Edge Christian story needs to be told and should be told right away. I don't think you could have brought Edge back and have him being involved with, I don't know, Kenny Omega first. Like, the partnership with Christian is just too obvious. And I don't mean partnership as, like, you know, together. I mean doing something
right.
with Christian. You had to introduce him that way. I mean, their friendship is very well known, especially to the AEW fan base. I don't think you could get away with having him, like, completely on a different storyline, separate from Christian to start. I think you needed to have them together, whether they're on the same side or not. So I've kind of come around to the idea of Edge being on the opposite side of Christian, although I think it, you know, I thought at first it would have made more sense to put them together, given their friendship and given people would see that Christian was the one who brought Edge into AEW. The only thing that I really didn't care for about this, and as well produced as I thought it was, the introduction of Edge, where he's driving the fast car and stuff like that, it's like,
yeah. This
is kind of like a spur of the moment coming out to make the save. Like, how do you have all of that ready to go, right? Like, it's...
Yeah.
Or was this, like, planned for some other time and you're just using it now? Like, that felt kind of weird to play that before you're coming out to make the save when, in theory, this is all a kind of spur-of-the-moment thing.
It also just felt unnecessary. I mean, it didn't feel like it added anything to the moment at all. I mean, they could have done our feature presentation thing if they really wanted to, but, I mean, I think that, you know, the crowd was already sort of ready for that frenzied moment. I mean, you could sense the thing going south very quickly. I mean, there was an awkwardness to how that whole thing was going down. And when Sting came out, it was like the crowd wanted to cheer, but it was also like, well, you're not the hero we want right now. Cause they knew, mm-hmm. I mean, they knew that it was likely coming. And they held off on it for so long that I started to think maybe they aren't doing this. And for a moment I was like, oh boy, this is going to go really poorly, because you could kind of sense that unrest with the crowd starting to build. And then so to draw it out even further by having that video package, I thought was a misstep. I mean, granted, in the end, it barely mattered, but hindsight being 2020, I think you just hit the you think you know him and you go.
Yeah. What do you think of the match, Christian versus Darby Allin? You know, Darby, I thought for the most part was restrained until the spot where Christian, and it took him two or three tries, threw him from the apron onto the steel steps, which, you know, and I tweeted about this at Greg M. Parks. It's like, you know, it was made a big deal, this list of AEW do's and don'ts for the wrestlers. Like, you have to get this kind of stuff approved ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, to prevent some of the more dangerous spots that we had been seeing on TV and on pay-per-view. And then you have a spot like this. It's like, if those things are going to get approved that are obviously way more dangerous than need be, what's the point of even having them? You know, I'd like, maybe it's quality control, so you're not having someone do two like spots in a row, in matches in a row, so they have to be approved by the coaches. But, like, it's just, that's a move to me that is exactly what that list was set out to prevent from happening. Somebody stepping in and being the voice of reason and saying, no, Darby Allin, maybe that's a bit over the line of what you need to do in this match. Even though the whole point of it was he needed to do something to be put on a stretcher so that Christian could splash. So it had to be dangerous looking, I guess, to reach that point where Darby is put on a stretcher. But I don't know, maybe I'm digressing a little too much. Maybe I'm just being overly protective or whatever, but you know, I look at those list of rules and the big deal that was made, not necessarily by AEW, but by, you know, Blah Online, who are reading them, and then I see a spot like this in a match, and I'm like, I thought that was kind of to prevent this sort of thing.
The list that you bring up seems to have largely been for show. I at least have not noticed any dramatic change in the way that matches are worked since that decree came down. I mean, maybe for the first couple of weeks or so, you saw them taking it a little easy, but I think that the level of danger is still there on a pretty consistent and regular basis with them. I do agree, though, Darby was a little bit more restrained in this match, and I think maybe that's because they wanted to sell the effect of what was eventually to come, and that's good, because that's not something that AEW has a great track record of doing. They so often go all the way out with some of their maneuvers and things that really should put a reasonable human being down for a three count instead are just tossed aside as early moves in a match that bear no effect. So I liked this. I liked the fact that they saved it for one big spot. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of Darby Allin's calling card, right? Like, he's the stuntman. I thought the match worked for what it was. It felt like window dressing for what we kind of knew what was to come, but they worked hard and they told a compelling story. I thought that you know, Christian was perfectly dastardly.
at this point. I mean, like the stuff with Nick Wayne's mom and the you know, the comments he's made about various dead fathers have gotten Christian to a point of like almost kind of being over as a babyface just because he's funny and, you know, he's so committed to the character. But for the most part, Darby Allin was able to rein them in and keep them on his side, which I thought was a good thing overall. When this was announced as the main event, you know, you kind of felt like the only way that that would be happening was if Edge were going to be showing up at some point during the match. And so I think that they did the best that they could given the circumstances and made it feel like a compelling main event overall. Nothing on this show from top to bottom, despite all being very good, necessarily felt like a main event to me. I mean, even Brian and Zack Sabre Jr., which was an incredible match, I mean, just doesn't seem like the type of match that you would close a show with.
Yeah, and I guess that was going to be my next question, because I had David Bryant on last weekend, and one of the things we were discussing when looking at this card was, okay, what match main events? Because I think you could have picked about half the show and made the argument for it main eventing. And I thought, ooh, that's, you know, that's a good question to ask Brandon on the post show. But as it turns out, how the main event progressed and then the post match, you couldn't have done that, including the Edge debut.
What?
You know, on the third match on the card, right? I mean, that
right.
That had to be the main event. So, as you said, you know, once Darby versus Christian was revealed as the main event, you know, you could kind of count on Edge maybe making an appearance. So, that
my assumption
crystallized
is
things,
that
I think.
Edge, yeah. My assumption was that Edge may not have been a super late addition, but maybe a late confirmation, because in the lead up to the event, I mean, for the last couple of weeks, and if you look at like the promos on both Fight TV and Bleacher Report, the indication was that Brian and Zack Sabre Jr. was in fact the main event. So it almost seems like they pivoted within the last week or so when they got confirmation for sure that Copeland was going to be available.
This is Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, along with PWTorch.com contributor Brandon LeClaire, and this is Wrestling Night America, the post-AEW Wrestle Dream show. Love for you to join us, emailing us WNIALivecast@gmail.com or calling in 515-605-9345. Brandon, let's take a look at the rest of the card, some of the highlights here. FTR versus Aussie Open to retain the AEW tag titles. FTR gets the victory. That sets them up with another showdown with the Young Bucks, who defeated the Guns, Penta, and Rey Fénix, as well as Hook and Orange Cassidy, to win a future AEW tag team title match. Can we pencil that in for Full Gear, the Bucks versus FTR, do you think?
Seems pretty likely at this point, unless they... I'm not sure, but I assume that they don't have any like super TV cards coming up, like the Fiend Dynamites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought FTR versus Aussie Open was a really strong tag team match. I thought the Bucks match was the usual kind of messy multi-team match that you get every once in a while. So both tag team matches, but both very different. FTR and Aussie Open was much more traditional, I thought. So, you know, this was another one of those cards where it seemed like there was a little bit of something for everybody.
Yeah, I enjoyed both matches for the most part for what they were. I mean, the four-way is, it's not necessarily my thing. It's particularly challenging to cover, for one. But even just as a fan, just watching the match, I think I've seen enough of them at this point to kind of know the general ebb and flow and the hits and the beat by beat. It was fine. It was a Bucks match. The thing that stood out to me, I think, the most was how lukewarm the crowd was toward the Young Bucks. I think that there is going to be a long-standing sentiment coming out of the CM Punk debacle that is extended even beyond just fans of CM Punk, but to a lot of AEW's crowds in general, where the tide has shifted a little bit on the Young Bucks. And I understand why. I mean, they are getting, it feels like they're getting the blame rather than Hangman Page and or Kenny Omega. Those two mm-hmm. seem pretty safe in their spot. I mean, Page was obviously the heel tonight, but there was a very good reason for that. The Young Bucks are starting, the cracks are starting to form there with the crowd's, you know, illusionment with them. And I think you're going to see that continue to go. And I would like to see a stronger separation at this point between the Bucks and between Omega. Just given, you know, Omega's standing currently, I think that he's better off as a singles competitor. I think he's taken a lot more seriously when he's not involved in the Bucks, and I think that the Bucks are probably going to be pretty prime for a heel run if they would like to go in that direction.
Speaking of Kenny Omega, the Don Callis family defeating Omega, Jericho, and Kota Ibushi, Sammy Guevara pins Chris Jericho in that match. That seems pretty significant, you know, given their deal that they have going on right now, Guevara and Jericho. So is this kind of the moment where AEW tries to run with Sammy Guevara, or if we look back 3 months from now, is he still going to be kind of mired in the same spot that he's in?
Yeah, I don't necessarily see this as a big elevation. I mean, especially in a tag match. You know, we've seen Konosuke Takeshita get the win over Kenny Omega a couple of times in these tag matches, and it hasn't really amounted to much of anything in the way of a singles push. And I sort of suspect that we're mm-hmm. looking at the same thing here. I like the Don Callis family, though. I mean, I certainly like the fact that Takeshita is in a notable role, and obviously Callis is a huge heat magnet. I just don't know where it goes ultimately. I mean, no one is going to really get their comeuppance on Don Callis. I mean, he's not going to get in the ring. So short of, you know, him taking a one-off bump or something, I just don't know what you really get from this in the end. I mean, is it really going to be that satisfying to see the likes of Kenny Omega and Chris Jericho defeat Will Ospreay and or Sammy Guevara and or Konosuke Takeshita? Because their beef is only with those guys in the periphery. I mean, the focal point of this rivalry and this angle is with Don Callis, and you just can't really do anything with him.
Omega versus Takeshita. If Omega wins, he gets 5 minutes alone in the ring with Don Callis. That's how we used to settle things by gum when we had a manager get in the way.
I mean, sure. If they could pull it, if Callis is willing to do it.
Hey, it made Bobby Heenan a star, or helped make him a star. So, Bryan Danielson and Zack Sabre. This is another match I mentioned on Twitter that it's kind of a long-standing dream match of mine, and while both guys are older, their bodies are a lot more beat up, I think it lived up to my expectations, just because what we saw tonight was that, you know, we see Zack Sabre have these kinds of matches with other wrestlers, but it's but he kind of reins it in a little bit, you know, because the other wrestlers are not necessarily as skilled technically as he is.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now he's got Bryan Danielson opposite the ring, and Danielson is as skilled technically as Sabre is. So now he doesn't have to hold anything back. And so that's what was cool for me about it as someone who enjoys Zack Sabre's style, to see someone be able to wrestle a style exactly like him, maybe even a shade better, was really, really cool. And knowing how much this meant to Bryan Danielson, that Sabre was a handpicked opponent of his, that he's having this match in Seattle, where he's mentioned in an interview that he just hasn't had that match in his hometown that, you know, he's really that proud of, or he, like, you mm-hmm. know, lived up to his kind of standards for wrestling. And to see him do that here tonight, was, you get a lot of satisfaction from, as a viewer, from watching it, even knowing, just knowing that one of the wrestlers in this match And you saw it when Bryan Danielson left the ring. Like, he had this huge smile on his face. He was pleased. And he had every right to be. This was just awesome all the way around.
Yeah, I love this. I'm someone who really thrives off of storytelling in wrestling. And so when you get a match that gets heralded as a dream match, but it really doesn't have anything on paper behind it in terms of a story, I'm a little trepidatious. And I knew going in, like, no question, they're going to have a hell of a match. Of course they are. It's Zack Sabre Jr. and Bryan Danielson. What could go wrong short of, you know, an untimely injury? But I was still, you know, just a little reserved in the fact that the match just kind of got made. We didn't really get a story behind it. But even with that in mind, I think that they were able to live up to any expectation that I might have had, and also tell a compelling story with the work that they did in the ring that I think made up for the lack of story coming into the match, you know, short of just the dream match aspect of it. I thought that the early advantage that Sabre Jr. took was really strong, and commentary did a really good job of you know, going beat for beat with this. And in particular, I wanted to highlight Jon Moxley during this match, because there were some moments where, you know, he was just completely off the cuff and saying things that were funny little anecdotes about Bryan Danielson, but didn't really have any bearing on the context of the match. But he did such an incredible job at the outset explaining that even though these two are very similar in terms of the style of, in terms of their moveset and their repertoire when it comes to submission holds, he did a fantastic job explaining how different their attitudes were and why one guy might have an advantage in a certain situation and another might have an advantage in another. And he talked about Brian's aggression and how much, you know, he enjoys getting hit and how much he enjoys this level of competition. And I just thought that he added a really, really cool flair to the match that elevated it up another level beyond, you know, the storytelling and the work that they were doing in the ring. I loved some of the major spots here, like the double leg hold with Bryan and Sabre Jr. sitting up and basically just getting right in each other's faces, and Bryan spits on Sabre, and Sabre slaps him in the face. There was just some awesome, awesome stuff here. I mean, this was by far my favorite match of the night. I certainly understand why it didn't main event. And like I said, it didn't even necessarily fit as a main event, but it was the highlight for me, for sure.
The commentary seemed to range from train wreck to awesome, and like nothing in between during that match. Cause you had Moxley, who was like talking all over the announcers and they would try to say something, but then he'd have these pieces of gold. You had JR, mm-hmm. who is JR, you know, he has his moments, but you know, sometimes it's pretty rough. And then you had Nigel and Excalibur. So it was an experience listening to them. I mean, it was, like I said, it ranged anywhere from just awful to really good in the span of an entire match. So
Did you happen to catch when I think it was when Zack Sabre Jr. was throwing some penalty kicks and Moxley was comparing him to a field goal kicker in football, and you know, said to JR, "Tell me a football kicker."
Yes. I tweeted that exact quote out because I thought it was just perfect. So yes, I most certainly caught that. The match before it also had Jon Moxley on commentaries, Ricky Starks defeating Wheeler Yuta. And I guess this is part of the problem with shows like Wrestle Dream, these four-hour extravaganzas where you have 10 matches, even more, if you count the 90-minute pre-show that I believe this was. I don't watch pre-shows, so I don't know. Is you have a match like Ricky Starks versus Wheeler Yuta, which was a really good match. Seems like an important win for Ricky Starks over a member of the Blackpool Combat Club. And no one's going to remember it tomorrow. because there was just so much else to process over the course of this show. So I do kind of feel bad because it was a good match, but no one's going to talk about it.
Yep. It was one of a couple here that I felt like could have been cut for time. I know that Tony loves to do these 4-hour shows, and because he thinks, you know, everybody's getting their fill, but I feel like there are a couple of matches that get lost in the shuffle because of the constant barrage of action. And as a result, like, because they don't let anything breathe or take any time to have come downs, it does a disservice to the big moments on your show. And I think that you can point to that on pretty much every AEW pay-per-view in history. I can't really think of one that didn't at least suffer a little bit because of just the barrage of match after match after match after match with no breathing room. And I think that if you cut a match or two here, I mean, this is a 10-match main card show. That's a lot to fit into 4 hours. And this is one of those matches that might just have been better served, you know, headlining a Dynamite or a Rampage, or, well, probably not Rampage, but a Dynamite or a Collision. I just think that it could have marinated in the fans' minds a little bit more had it not been stuck in the middle of this show. But it was good for what it was, and Starks needed a big win.
Swerve Strickland over Hangman Adam Page. Swerve, the babyface in his hometown of Seattle. Adam Page, the heel. Despite the story that is being told here, and this was a match that I really liked the buildup. I really thought that this, you know, take away the edge stuff, I really thought that this could have been a match that could be a main event of this show. Mm-hmm. And the match was good, but it just felt like it was missing something. I don't know. Did you get that sense as well?
I really liked the match. I had a weird feeling about it coming in because, and I noted this in my report for PW Torch, when Strickland came out, there just didn't seem to be that much of a reaction. And the announcers went hard from the get-go, hammering home the point that, you know, this was going to be an adverse reaction to Hangman Page. And maybe for the first time in his career, he, you know, wasn't going to have the fans by his side. And it was going to be a heavy Swerve Strickland crowd. And the original onset with the entrances seemed to make liars out of him. And then, of course, like, the match gets going and very quickly it changes. And everything they said becomes very true. They get very, very into Swerve Strickland. And so I just wondered if maybe, like, the crowd was poorly mic'd for the entrances, if, you know, the reactions just weren't there. I don't know. But during the match itself, I mean, Strickland was the heavy, heavy favorite from the crowd, very clearly. They did not like Hangman Page in the slightest. I'm probably a little bit higher on the match itself than you were. I thought it was really good. I thought that there were some really neat near falls and counters near the end there. I mean, this match, like most matches on this show, just a lot of interference, which is something AEW goes to the well on a little bit too frequently. Strickland gets a big, impressive win, and I think that's the important thing coming out of here. I mean, it's Swerve Strickland's first major singles win against an AEW favorite on a big stage. But, I mean, it wasn't clean. It certainly wasn't clean. And I think that's obviously to protect their individual designations coming out of this show, where you would expect a more traditional reaction from other crowds. But still, I mean, it's marred a little bit for me by the finish.
Talked about the Young Bucks match, going back up the card, Chris Statlander defeating Julia Hart to retain the TBS title. David and I also disagreed last week on this. I thought that this would be a good time to pull the trigger on Julia Hart to get the TBS title. I didn't think that Chris Statlander's title reign had matched the expectations that were set when she had beat Jade Cargill. Because that moment had been building for so long with Jade's winning streak and everything like that. And then Statlander is finally the one to get the victory, and then you're expecting, you know, fireworks and rainbows and unicorns for Chris Statlander going forward, and it's been kind of meh, you know, her title reign has. I don't think they've really done a good job of establishing her character, who she is, what her motivations are, and things like that. So on the opposite end of the spectrum, you've got Julia Hart, who has just improved by leaps and bounds over the last year from a character perspective as well as from an in-ring perspective. She does feel like she's got a lot of momentum behind her, but there did seem to be a divide heading into this match between people who thought Statlander needed to keep the TBS title and the people that thought Julia Hart should win here. What side were you on, and you know, were you on the same side by the end of the match?
So I'm a firm believer in capitalizing on momentum whenever you can in the AEW women's division, and I say that because I have been a very, very big detractor of this division from the outset. I think that it is by far the weakest spot and point that AEW has. It continues to be an issue. They've promised to get better. They haven't gotten better. In fact, if anything, I'd argue that they've gotten a little worse. They, since the company's existence, they've managed to create two pretty sizable stars, and those are Britt Baker and Jade Cargill. Say what you will about Britt Baker, but she certainly, you know, did plenty to get herself over on AEW TV in those early days. And Jade Cargill had the rocket strapped to her back and got over by being, you know, an impressive specimen and by hitting some pretty unique power moves and being protected in a way that we had not seen in that division yet. Jade is now gone, of course. Chris Statlander is the person who got the rub from her impressive winning streak, and I was not a fan of how they went about it when they did it. I would have preferred to have seen Statlander come in and earn the title shot, because the way that they set it up, to me, did not make Statlander seem like a sympathetic babyface. She was taking advantage of a tired Jade Cargill who'd already wrestled a match. And I think that crowd reactions and general interest in Statlander since that time have bore out that opinion. I think that the crowd was really into Statlander at the jump, but like you said, Greg, they've done a poor job at defining her character. They haven't been giving her particularly compelling opponents or interesting feuds. She hasn't really had feuds at all, because again, that is something that they so often fail at in the AEW women's division. And so we get to this match tonight with Julia Hart, who on the opposite end of the spectrum has been building a credible win streak, has been getting over organically with the crowd, is part of the House of Black, which has consistently been over on the AEW product since debuting. And I thought tonight was the time to pull the trigger and strike while the iron was hot, because in a division that has had so few wins over the years, I think you need to take wins when you can get them. And to me, pulling the trigger on Julia Hart tonight was a slam dunk win, and they missed it. And I think it hurts her going forward, and I don't think it does anything to have Statlander be the one to beat her. You could feel the sentiment shifting from the crowd tonight already. There was, I would say, a modest reaction for Statlander at best, and by the time the match got going, it was very split. And I think that there was a strong sentiment in that crowd that they wanted to see Hart win. You heard the cheers when she climbed to the top rope for that moonsault. I think they wanted her to go over, and I think they missed an opportunity.
The second match was Eddie Kingston defeating Katsuyori Shibata to retain the ROH Championship and the Strong Openweight title. Another one of these matches, kind of like Starks and Yuta, that, you know, it happened in at the half-hour mark of the show, and by the four-hour mark, it was all but forgotten, I think. But, you know, a good match, the strong style that Shibata brings, that Eddie Kingston likes to wrestle, that Japanese style. So, again, when you're talking about a card of this size, 10 matches on it, and the last thing you want is matches that feel the same. So I think this is one of those matches that, like I pointed out before, at least felt different from the other matches on the card, which I think is a positive.
Yeah, I thought this was good. You know, kind of what you would expect out of Kingston and Shibata. It was, like you said, a fair bit different from the rest of the card, and it's good that it stands out, but it happened so early in the night, and so much other stuff happened, and so many other great matches took place that it's easy to just kind of forget about it. So, yeah, this is another one I agree that may have been better served on Dynamite or Collision.
Yeah. And then the opener, MJF. Never before has a world champion jerked so many curtains as MJF has as part of this tag team with Adam Cole, who is injured and was not in the match. So he took on the Righteous in a two-on-one match and won to retain the ROH tag titles. So, and again, there's two schools of thought here, much like the Julia Hart situation. First, that MJF is doing a fantastic job because the crowd is eating everything up that he does, even the simplest stuff. And on the opposite end of that is, this man is your world champion, and he is slumming it in ROH tag titles, making a joke out of everything, not taking everything seriously. This is why the attendance is down. This is why the ratings are down. All of that stuff. Put it on MJF's back. Like most things, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. I think the nice thing about this is fans have been complaining about the Righteous getting this opportunity for a while. You know, they're an ROH team. They kind of came out of nowhere, although they've gotten some wins lately on TV and gotten some video packages to help suss out their characters. But people were looking at this and saying, you're wasting an MJF Adam Cole pay-per-view match on this ROH tag team. And so the fact that MJF beat them 2-on-1, you don't get the usual complaints you'd get if this was any other tag team. Oh, they're being buried. Oh, you know, how can they lose 2-on-1? Well, if people don't care about them to begin with and think they're not good enough for this slot, then MJF winning 2-on-1 is not that big of a deal, I guess, is sort of the silver lining of that. But so, you know, the whole argument about what MJF should be doing as champion versus what they do have him doing, as entertaining as it might be and as into it as the live crowds are, where do you fall on that idea that just what MJF is doing generally? Is it good, or should he be doing something more appropriate for a typical company world champion?
I think I'm still in the same spot that I've been since this whole thing got underway, which is that I'm really entertained by it pretty consistently, but I also think it's probably bad for the business. And that's an interesting spot to be in because I enjoy the segments. I get a kick out of MJF being, you know, quote unquote, your scumbag. But I think it's all beneath him and beneath the world title. So I exist in both camps, I guess. I wasn't a big fan of them utilizing another tag team match to get MJF on a pay-per-view card. I think that you need to... WWE has been doing this pretty frequently with their B-level pay-per-views. They don't feature Roman Reigns. And I think they wanted a secondary title so that those pay-per-views would feel more important and they would still have a world title defense. And that has largely not worked. I mean, Rollins' title feels certainly subsidiary to the Universal Championship. And AEW has sort of come up with their own answer to this, which is to create this diversion away from the AEW world title by having this buddy comedy between Adam Cole and MJF where they win the Ring of Honor tag titles and they do this kind of sideshow that keeps MJF from defending the world title. And I just don't think it's great for business. I mean, part of the reason I was relatively, you know, disinterested in this card on paper was because it didn't feel like it had a marquee matchup. It just felt like a collection of matches that, yeah, they're probably going to be really good, but we don't really know that they're going to mean much in the end. And part of that has a lot to do with the fact that MJF has just been working these mid-card stories for the better part of the last couple of months, save the main event with Adam Cole at All In. And even then, they were doing the mid-card stuff before in the pre-show. I think that the Ring of Honor tag team titles are beneath both Cole and MJF. I don't love the fact that, you know, MJF is opening shows with guys in Ring of Honor that people don't even seem particularly familiar with. I mean, when The Righteous came out, you could hear a pin drop in that place. I mean, people just did not care about them in the slightest. So on one hand, it's great that MJF beat them because he's the world champion and he should. But having him in that position in the first place is probably not great.
So, you know, I totally understand that argument. My alternative theory to that is the story of their opponents doesn't matter. MJF and Cole versus The Righteous, that doesn't matter. The story is MJF and Cole. The story is MJF, Cole, and Roddy Strong. The story is MJF, Cole, Roddy Strong, and the Kingdom. Like, that is – the other stuff is fluff. Doesn't matter. That's just a means to an end. The story they're telling, which seems to me to be pretty intricate, the way they've woven the inclusion of Strong and, you know, Taven and Bennett into things, is the constant developing friendship. Or is it between Cole and MJF? And so, you know, that is the whole thing. The other stuff and who they're fighting almost doesn't matter, which, again, you can say, hey, maybe that's not a great thing, but, and, you know, you refer to them as mid-card storylines, but the real storyline is Cole and MJF, and that's the main event storyline. I mean, that is the one that's getting a lot of TV time, they're getting a lot of video packages, all this kind of stuff. So, you know, is the fact that that storyline is, and I've seen some people, and I think it's even been on this show, compared to the Bloodline, at least in the early days where you're starting this out. It's a, you know, it's a long-form storyline. There's three-dimensional characters. You have MJF, who's always been a heel. He's trying to be babyface, but you see in the matches that he's still heelish. He's maybe compelling Adam Cole to act a little more heelish than he normally would in matches, cheating to help MJF win. So you have these characters that are more well-rounded than a lot of the other characters you see on the show. It's involving other characters in it. It's an obviously long-term storyline. Does the fact that that story is compelling to a lot of people at least make up for the fact that they're kind of facing tomato cans like The Righteous on pay-per-views?
Yeah, I think that you bring up a great point, and I think they would have been in a better position tonight if not for the untimely injury to Adam Cole, because what you ended up getting was a situation where they couldn't advance the storyline in any meaningful way, and therefore you were just stuck with the mid-card handicap match. And that's why it felt so beneath MJF to be in this position, because Cole wasn't involved, you know, the Roddy wasn't involved in any way. Bennett and Taven weren't involved in any way. So as a result, it just looks like Max in a match that's clearly beneath him against characters that people don't care about. But I definitely agree that Cole and MJF is a main event storyline. The only issue that I think is getting in the way of it being a true money-drawing angle is the fact that there's a lot of comedy there. And for as heartfelt as some of the stuff with Cole and MJF has been. I mean, you look at a character like Roderick Strong, and they're trying to play up this very real friendship and history between Cole and Roddy, but Strong's whole involvement in this angle has been essentially reduced to a meme of him yelling at him over and over again.
Best character work he's ever done, though, that I've seen. Maybe that speaks more to his acting skills and history with what he's been given, but I don't know that I've ever found him more entertaining than I do now.
He's certainly certainly a lot of fun. Like I said, I mean, I get a kick out of all of it. I love it. It's usually my favorite part of AEW TV. But do I think it's good for business? Probably
yeah.
not.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, it's entertaining. The live crowds love it. I guess the question is, and we just have no way of answering this, how much of the, you know, I hate to use the word downturn because that's maybe a little too extreme, but how much is the lack of ticket sales and the lower ratings a function of the MJF storyline or MJF not defending the AEW championship in storylines or whatever the case may be versus any number of other reasons that AEW could be suffering, including just the ascension of WWE and how WWE has gotten hot. And historically in this business, when there's multiple companies, major companies, when one gets hot, the other goes down, even if the quality doesn't necessarily go down of that show. So, you know, there are a lot of factors beyond just MJF and what he's doing with the, or what he's not doing with the AEW title to think about when we are looking at the business numbers of AEW. So I want to close the Wrestle Dream discussion with an email that we just received from Keith. He says, "Howdy. In 1995, everyone was buzzing about Michael Jordan returning to the NBA from retirement versus the Orlando Magic. It was an electric atmosphere. Jordan came out, but he was wearing an Orlando Magic jersey with the number 45. What a turncoat. The Magic got the tip ball and it went to Jordan. Only Jordan dribbled to the other goal and scored. Huh? It was a swerve. He was really with the Bulls all along. Remember that? Of course you don't, because it didn't happen, because that would have been stupid. Attention, Adam Copeland, Nick Wayne, and professional wrestling bookers, stop it." That is from Keith. So I don't know. I'm assuming he's talking about both Adam Copeland and Nick Wayne. Maybe it's the Copeland teasing the concerto before turning. Maybe it's the whole Nick Wayne turn. Obviously, Keith didn't like the way those played out. We didn't talk about teasing, hitting the concerto. Was that a little too much? You think in the main event segment?
I lost you there for a second. What was the last part?
Sorry. Was the Edge tease of a concerto before turning, right after Nick Wayne had just turned? Was that a little too much? Was that putting a hat on a hat, to borrow a phrase?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little too on the nose. The thing is, it's such commonplace in pro wrestling, and I mean, WWE does it, AEW does it. You see it kind of all the time. I'm almost desensitized to it. But I do wish that there'd be a little bit less of just, you know, like, we're swerving to swerve, and you know, when mm-hmm. people pretty much know what's coming. They'd already done the tease of whether or not it was going to be Edge or whether or not he was going to come out. Man, it's going to be really hard to stop calling him Edge.
I don't know that I'm going to stop. I may just keep calling him Edge.
I know. In other news, I found out somehow, I could not tell you how this occurred. I'm Edge blocked me on Twitter. I've never tweeted at the man in my life. I don't know. But I happen to see AEW's announcement.
Let me check to see my status. Oh, I am not blocked. Oh, wow.
Huh. Well,
okay.
Maybe I said one too many mean things about his incarnation of Judgment Day, and he was vanity searching. I don't know. I certainly don't tag wrestlers. I will say,
like most people who tweet about wrestling, I am blocked by Shawn Michaels. So there's that, I guess.
I don't think I am. I don't know what I did. Big fan of Edge, always have been. But I would have preferred that they just went the straightforward route. But it's par for the course.
So before we go and sign off, I do want to talk about NXT No Mercy, which took place Saturday night. It's another two-for-one weekend here. So I want to do that by reading an email from John. He sent in an email earlier today about No Mercy. He says, "Hi, Greg and Brandon. Hope you're both doing well. What a phenomenal NXT PLE/pay-per-view it was tonight. And a great showcase of the present and future of WWE/wrestling in general. The final two matches were arguably 10 out of 10, especially Carmelo Hayes, Ilya Dragunov, which was a very well-told story, extremely physical, and really had both a very hopeful and sporting vibe to it with two young, supremely talented, and driven athletes fighting to win. It was also a real test for whether Carmelo could hang with Dragunov as a fighter as much as a wrestler, and I think he did just that. But Dragunov's perseverance and killer instinct was too much. Similarly, I also really liked the Tiffany Stratton-Becky Lynch match and feel like Carmelo, this could be a defining moment for Tiffany, even in defeat, and she showed something that was beyond just being very gifted athletically, but they were laying it in, and it was fantastic. The spot with the dolls could have potentially come across a little too silly in many other contexts, but it fit the story they've been telling, and the performers made it work. Both matches were highly physical, featured great storytelling, and I think elevated the people involved, especially Carmelo and Tiffany, who felt like they gained a lot, even in defeat. The rest of the card was good as well, and I thought Breaker Corbin was much better than I would have thought going in, although the interference was disappointing. But I suppose there's more story to tell, and they'll have another match. The tag title match was also a great showcase for tag team wrestling, and well worked. Dominic Mysterio finally losing the NXT North American title was probably the weakest match on the card, but that's not to denigrate it because the rest of the card was so strong. Question. Becky versus Tegan Nox is next, but how long do you think Becky's reign will last? And the same question relating to Ilya Dragunov. And do you think Trick Williams is likely to turn on Carmelo, or will both he and Carmelo remain babyface? So I don't assume that Becky's title reign will be long-term. I don't think you can have someone the level of Becky on the main roster holding an NXT title for too long. So I would say that's going to be a short one. Ilya Dragunov, I could see him holding it for a while. Presumably Carmelo Hayes either goes to the main roster after losing this title or maybe feuds with Trick Williams if one of them turns heel now that Trick has the title and Hayes does not. And I don't really see, there's not a ton of guys just banging down the door, I don't think, to be in that main event scene. So Dragunov has the potential to hold this title for a while. You know what you're getting with him on top. You're getting, like, strong matches. You're getting a guy who's willing to throw himself into things for better or worse, and just the level of violence that he brings. So I think having him on top in these NXT PLEs would be good. And then the next part of the question, do you think Trick Williams is likely to turn on Carmelo, or will both he and Carmelo remain babyface? Yeah, I think it would be more likely Carmelo turns on Trick because Carmelo is jealous of Trick Williams holding a title and he doesn't. So that's kind of how I would see it if it happens. And I'm not saying it's going to happen. I could see, again, either Carmelo moving to the main roster, maybe Carmelo and Trick remain babyfaces. But what do you think about those three components there? How long Becky holds the title, how long Dragunov holds the title, and a potential turn in the Hayes-Trick Williams partnership?
Yeah, so first of all, unrelated, but I am not blocked by Shawn Michaels on Twitter. I checked.
Damn.
So I guess a win for me there.
Yeah.
Becky doesn't feel like a long-term champion to me either. I think that her spot is obviously on the main roster. It feels to me like having the title on Becky is a very, very conscious push to have significant star power at the top of their shows while they look to package Raw and NXT for a new TV deal. So I think that Becky's run in NXT is going to be entirely predicated on how long it takes for Raw and NXT to find a presumably new home, given that USA has taken on a big contract for SmackDown. So I think that was the reason to put the title on her in the first place, and I think that she'll probably hold it until that occurs. I don't expect that it'll be a particularly long time before they find a landing spot for those shows, so I would expect that her dropping the title will correspond with that move. The Ilya Dragunov situation, I thought that the match was good. I thought that he showed, a lot of promise, a lot of fire in that match. I think that he'll be a fun champion for that show. And I haven't followed NXT closely in quite some time. I'm mostly a PLE viewer at this point, and when I get around to them, I rarely get to watch them live. So I can't think of anyone off the top of my head that's really in the wings waiting to challenge him for that title. So that might be an issue that they have to contend with for a little while. It wouldn't surprise me if, again, like they've done with Becky, they bring some main roster guys over to contend for that title for a bit, just for the purpose of drawing ratings to that show. And then as far as Carmelo and Trick go, it seemed to me very likely, based on the fact that they closed the show officially with that backstage exchange between the two, that a turn is coming sooner rather than later. I don't think that you put that at the very end of the show unless you're teasing something big. So to me, it makes sense, like you said, that Carmelo is the one to turn on Trick, given that he no longer has a championship. And that would sort of follow a pattern that WWE has had for a while with these NXT call-ups. I think it would make a lot of sense for Carmelo to work with Trick a bit, probably put Trick over on his way out and up to the main roster.
And then the next part of John's question says, also very quickly, I want to ask about your thoughts on Jade Cargill. I've never seen AEW, but I've listened to podcasts talking about the promotion, and I've heard positive things about her. But it feels like the way WWE built her up on SmackDown that she is one of the biggest stars ever. From the way they spoke about her, she seems like a Rock 2.0 in terms of star power in WWE and a potential as a crossover attraction. And I feel you cannot have her come in any less than a main event megastar way. I'd have her come in against Charlotte Flair, probably the best opponent, and definitively beat her, as I feel Charlotte is so established and has so much credibility that I think she can afford to put over a new megastar in the making. It would also be a new way to present Charlotte, who is so often in the title picture and is likely in the final chapter of her career. I would do it non-title, presuming Cargill comes in within the next month. But it obviously depends on when Jade Cargill comes in and whether Charlotte is available or on hiatus at the time. It depends on her readiness, but I would think if she isn't ready, then she could come in Rumble time, and you could have her win the Rumble, but that means Charlotte would need to be champion again to do this particular match. But I just think with the way they spoke about her on SmackDown, you kind of have to debut her relatively quickly and at the top of the card to capitalize on that momentum. Otherwise, if it takes months for her to debut, it could seem like she's essentially a rookie who needs to train like everyone else at the Performance Center instead of a massive free agent signing who is or could be one of the biggest stars ever. Question, when would you debut Jade Cargill, and who would be your top three choices for her to feud against, either her first opponent or first three opponents in succession? For me, it would be Charlotte, Io Sky, and Becky Lynch / Rhea Ripley, depending on who's champion on Raw at the time, as top choices to face her. Keep up the great work. Thank you, John, for your email. I do agree with the crux of the email that Jade probably should be brought in as a top star right off the bat, and certainly her introduction on SmackDown from the announcers made it seem like that's what they're preparing for her to do. I don't know that Charlotte would be the first one. Charlotte has a tendency to kind of eat people up a little bit, both on the mic and in matches, so I'm not sure that you want to put someone like Cargill with her right away. I think Rhea Ripley is interesting. I think, you know, Jade Cargill versus Bianca Belair from a pure athletic standpoint would be awesome. Mm-hmm. I would say Rhea Ripley, Bianca Belair, and let's throw Asuka in there. Asuka, I think, is the kind of veteran who, you know, Jade Cargill is still green. I mean, she's still, you know, if you watch her matches in AEW, she certainly improved over that time, but she still has a ways to go to really be at that level that fans have come to expect from top WWE women's matches. I mean, you look at Charlotte Flair, Becky Lynch, Asuka, Bianca Belair, they're all in that four-star match range when they are put in the spotlight. I don't think Jade Cargill is there yet. So Asuka would be the perfect veteran, I think, to work with her, maybe even on the house show circuit, to you know, that sort of veteran presence there. So those are some names that come into my mind. Do you have any names that you'd like to see Jade Cargill work with? And do you agree putting her at the top of the card right away? I know there's some people saying, no, put her in NXT. Let her get more experience there. Let her not go on the main roster where expectations are huge, the four-star matches, the big names. Let her kind of get her WWE footing, even if it's for 3 months in NXT before you bring her up. What's your take on where she should start?
I am actually fine with either. And I say that with the caveat being that if you're going to put her in NXT, I think that you need to set the table very quickly and establish her as the star of that show beyond everybody else. Mm-hmm. Everybody takes a backseat to her the moment that she arrives. And I think that they could do that. I think they're capable of putting someone in that position. And I think that she would thrive in that position, especially if she happened to be the one to take the title off of Becky Lynch. Because then that creates a very interesting dynamic down the road when Jade does come back to the main roster and Becky is there waiting for her rematch. So that's an intriguing prospect, an intriguing scenario to me. I also think that there's nothing wrong with shooting her right to the top of the division on the main roster. My only caveat with that is the stuff that you've brought up, Greg, which is that she is still very green, and the expectations in AEW were substantially lower. They have a lot of talented women there, but they are not expected to carry main event segments. They're just not. It's not what they've been asked to do. And on occasion, they've been put in that role, and I think largely they've succeeded when they've been asked to do that. But that is not what that division has been tailored to be. And in WWE, there is an expectation that, like you said, their top women can work 4-plus star matches. They have to be able to work a long-form 15- to 20-minute style WWE main event. And I don't think that Jade is there yet. I mean, we've mm-hmm. seen enough of her in AEW to know that ring-wise, once she I don't know for certain what her longest match in AEW was, but I don't think she went much longer than 10 minutes at any on any occasion, which would mean she's still only about halfway there from, you know, having the ring cardio, having the pacing, having all of that stuff that you need to work that style of match in WWE. She's not there. So that's why I sort of almost lean to a dominant NXT run first. But if it is mm-hmm. going to be main roster and they're going to shoot her right to the top, I think you have to protect her the way that you protected Cody Rhodes. And not to say they're similar in the ring. Cody Rhodes, obviously an accomplished wrestler who can handle himself in virtually any style you ask him to. But Cody Rhodes was presented in a very particular way. He was a star from day one. They told you he was a star. You knew that he became a star elsewhere, even though he'd wrestled in WWE before. But he didn't come in needing to prove himself all over again.
And that has to be how they treat Jade Cargill too. So far they have. I mean, if you listen to the way that they speak about her in the promos and the signing and all of that, they are already treating her like a star, and that's good. Because the last thing that you want is for her to, quote-unquote, have to pay her dues because she came from that other rival company.
Mm-hmm.
As far as people that she could work with, I like your idea of working with Asuka a bit. If they want to get her going with somebody on the house show circuit that can show her the ropes and take losses to her every night, put her out there with Natalya. I mean, there's nobody better.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point as well. I know that you are not a weekly viewer of the NXT TV, so I'm kind of interested, John went through and talked about the matches he enjoyed. We talked about some of the matches here. Anything stand out to you about No Mercy that you want to make mention of as someone who doesn't necessarily watch the weekly product?
Yeah, so I have not been a regular watcher of NXT since the 2.0 era started. At that point, I sort of made a conscious decision. AEW was ramping up, and I kind of had to say, I only have so much room in a week for wrestling, and something's going to have to take a back seat, and that was NXT. Now, I want to note that prior to NXT 2.0, NXT Black and Gold was and is still my favorite wrestling product of the last 10-plus years. I look back at that era very fondly, particularly the 2016 to 2018-ish, 2019-ish. I loved that product. I watched the weekly show religiously. This pay-per-view, first of all, I enjoyed very much. I mean, I thought it was a good show top to bottom. A little bit of over-reliance on interference, which I know Shawn Michaels is a little trigger-happy when it comes to that stuff, and maybe that will earn me my block on Twitter. I thought that...
Yeah, Michael, he's a big fan of the show, Brandon. Shawn Michaels.
I figured. Yeah. Word will get back to him, and then I'll get blocked. So I thought that it was a strong show, top to bottom. I really liked the fact that there was a hot crowd, a large crowd. It brought me back a little bit to the Black and Gold era. It felt like NXT was on the rise again, rather than kind of sitting in this stagnant place. The crowd was hot throughout. They were into the acts. They were into the characters. They were into the matches. It was just a really positive night overall. I would definitely pick the main event in terms of what I enjoyed the most. I thought Hayes and Dragunov was really good, but I just thought Stratton and Lynch hit a really good pace together. I thought they worked well together. I thought it lived up to WWE's moniker of Extreme Rules. They had some creative spots. I didn't love the Barbie pieces. I understood what they were going for. But when Becky pulled the bag out from under the ring, the crowd so clearly wanted thumbtacks, and it was so clear that we weren't getting thumbtacks, it almost seemed too on the nose for WWE's brand of violence. Like, here's these broken plastic doll parts instead of, metal thumbtacks. It's just, it was a little too on the nose. But still, I really enjoyed the match. I thought it went over really well, and Stratton looked like a star.
Yeah, I agree. Dragunov versus Hayes. I was surprised Dragunov won. He always came across in NXT as always the bridesmaid, never the bride. So to see him get the victory was a surprise to me, but a pleasant surprise. And then, as you mentioned, Becky Lynch versus Tiffany Stratton, I thought, was a fitting main event on this show. Becky Lynch retains the women's title, and Tiffany Stratton just keeps getting better and better. And you can definitely see I was not a real early adopter of hers in terms of, seeing a star there. But certainly she's come a long way in a short amount of time. We talked about that with Julia Hart, sort of honing in on her character and getting better in the ring at the same time. I think the same could be said for Tiffany Stratton as well. So, Brandon, thank you for hanging out late with me. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say it was good to see Becky back in a spot like that too. Like she's kind of been floundering for a bit, and the Trish feud didn't go over quite as well as I think a lot of people hoped. And she's such a star, and I mean she thrives in positions like this. And it was nice to see her back in a main event, just having a great match,
sure,
connecting with the crowd, getting a big win. It just felt right. It felt like something that, you know, they need to get back to on the main roster.
Absolutely. Brandon, we're going to be back next week doing the same thing, WWE Fastlane pay-per-view next Saturday night. So you'll find us right here next Saturday night on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Before we let you go, let the listeners know where they can find you on social media and your work for The Torch.
Sure. You can find me at BLeClaire12 on Twitter, or X, if you want to call it that. But
I'm just
going to
keep calling
Adam
Twitter.
Copeland
I don't
Edge.
Care. Let Elon Musk send his lawyers after me. I'm going to keep calling it Twitter.
Yeah. I'm going to call it Twitter, and I'm going to call Adam Copeland Edge. I don't care.
I've reached that. You know how old people just reach an age where they just say whatever they want and they don't think about the consequences?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm getting there.
So you can follow me on Twitter at BLeClaire12 for The Torch. I am responsible for AEW and paper and or AEW pay-per-view and WWE PLE Alt Perspective Report. So I do deep dive, in-depth reports on every match, blow by blow. Try to include timestamps, big happenings, and then I also include analysis for each match. And my final thoughts on the show, overall, I have yet to post said analysis for Wrestle Dream because as soon as the show was over, I hopped on this show. But I will be getting to that momentarily, and that will be up very shortly.
And Brandon's unfettered enthusiasm for doing these all reports are the reason we can have him here after every major show on Wrestling Night in America. So, Brandon, again, thank you so much for staying up late with us here tonight on Wrestling Night in America, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to you, listeners, again soon as well. Don't forget to email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. We'll be back here next Saturday night after Fastlane with another edition of Wrestling Night in America.